This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us for a look at this week's top stories in Cincinnati are WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Amanda and Chris, thanks for being here today. Good to see both of you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start off by talking about what happened in City Council this week. They had they struck a compromise on human services funding, and this involves $350,000 out of $4.3 million in human services funding. Amanda, how was this a bone of contention between Yvette Simpson and John Cranley?
Basically, it comes down to what they wanted the money, what issues they wanted the money to go to. So Yvette wanted the money to go to violence prevention. That's something that she's really been working on the last couple of months, years, introducing new programs aimed at children who might experience violence or see violence. And then on the other side, John Cranley wanted it to go to heroin, which is obviously a big issue that we hear about every day. So it really came down to which one will we fund, and they kind of split it down the split, ended up with a compromise and split it.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that compromise, Chris, that they came to.
I think that, you know, politically for the two of them, you know, that's like the best case scenario. I'm not sure that the voters are really honing in on the $350,000 and what it's going to be spent for. You know, it's one of those detailed city hall things, but it's just kind of emblematic of, you know, kind of the race that they're running. I mean, Cranley wrote an op-ed this week. They both had dueling op-eds this week about this topic. And, you know, I'm not sure how engaged the public is over the details other than they know that they, you know, need violence prevention funding and heroin, money to deal with the heroin epidemic. So, I'll be curious to see, you know, how much of an impact this actually has.
And that's what's so funny about this whole argument is every year council passes a huge budget. So they passed a $1.6 billion budget, and yet they find themselves arguing over this really small amount and not insignificant, but how big of a difference is $300,000 really going to make on the heroin epidemic. I mean, obviously people who get that money would argue they need every dime. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about such a small portion of the budget, and it's really turns into kind of political theater on some level.
So what was the council vote? What was the final vote on this? Eight to one, was it?
I don't know if PG – I know PG was trying to get in his vote at the last – because he had to go somewhere. I don't know what the final exact count on that was.
Yeah, I think they were – I mean, generally, it was well accepted.
I know Kevin Flynn was very upset about how the process played out during council, and he, I know, cast a no vote on it.
And Kevin was somebody who thought that all that money should be going to the opioid crisis, right?
Well, he also just raised issue with how the whole thing was playing out, basically, that it wasn't going through this vetted process, that at the last minute, council was once again – deciding where this money should go without this process, really. And that's what was so kind of interesting about this whole fight. At the end of the day, council was kind of fighting over the rules that they created to institute some more oversight and some more rhyme and reason to the nonprofits that do get funding in the city budget every year.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. So is that the end of this particular matter? Is there anything else that could arise out of this other than it being a campaign issue?
Yeah, I think, you know, from a nuts and bolts budget standpoint, I think it's done. They figured it out.
I do think it was really telling, at least from a political perspective. I thought it was very interesting, and everyone was kind of using this to their political advantage. Even, I know Councilwoman Amy Murray sent out a fundraising email after the vote saying, I helped with, you know, heroin funding. However, I do think it's telling what we'll see on the campaign trail, because John Cranley is going to really try and use the fact that crime is down as a campaign issue. And if Yvette Simpson is reminding voters at every corner that violence is still an issue, during the council meeting she was going on about the shootings that had happened recently, I think she'll try to remind voters that this is still very much an issue and that there still needs to be work to be done, kind of to delegitimize John Cranley's saying, hey, I've gotten crime down in the city.
Are there any oversights that are out there to track how effective crime prevention is, violent reduction, these violence reduction programs are?
I'm sure there are, but I don't know what they are.
One of the things council has pushed for in general, specifically Kevin Flynn and Amy Murray, is more oversight on the nonprofits that are getting funding. So they have to have performance measures. What are their goals? Are they meeting them? So that's something in general with handing out these funds to these nonprofits that council has tried to kind of rein in a little more.
Now, in the mayor's race, Chris, John Cranley has made some pretty big changes to his campaign staff.
Yeah, what he did was Jay Kincaid, who is his longtime campaign manager, he was his chief of staff, campaign manager in 2013, campaign manager for the primary in 2017. So he's going to take on a different role. He's going to be focused on policy, communications, and fundraising. Those are his kind of strengths as a political operative. And so he's brought in a new campaign manager. Her name is I'm going to mispronounce her first name probably, Chandra Youngbluth. And she, you know, she has some expertise in you know, what's kind of known in politics as field organizing, and these are the people that knock on your door and basically ask you to vote for their particular candidate. They'll call you on the phone. In recent years, they're texting you more. You know, there's all kinds of an email and Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. So there's the woman that he hired, you know, she has a lot of experience in field organizing. She's done it at the Hamilton County level. She's done it at the statewide level. She's worked for a union super PAC. So this is, you know, this is an indication that the mayor knows that he kind of got beaten in the primary, at least partially because of the ground game that Councilwoman Simpson had. She had a lot of people knocking on doors for her. She had a lot of people, calling their friends, texting their friends. And so I think that the mayor has recognized that that is a weak point in his campaign and that he's not going to just be able to win by trying to overwhelm her with his fundraising, which is still substantial, and campaign commercials. Those just didn't have the impact that he wanted them to have in the primary. So, and the other, even more interesting than the campaign manager change was they hired, I believe, 12 field organizing people. Well, they have a total of 12 people paid on the campaign, and a good chunk of them are field organizing types of people. Pardon me. But so that's a ton of staff for a mayoral race.
But this is an effort to boost that ground game.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a ton of staff. In 2013, I believe they had 4 staff members paid. And so now to go from three or four to 12 is, you know, it just shows the investment that he's trying to make there. And I don't think that Councilmember Simpson will be able to match in terms of paid staff that level. What she might do is have enthusiasm from people who are willing to go out and knock on those doors for free.
Yeah, I think the staff point is really interesting. I don't know any type of local race where we've seen that large of staff. I mean, you think about last year, Hamilton County, I don't think Joseph Dieters had any paid staff. And on the flip side, Denise Driehaus had like 2 paid staffers, and they're covering a whole
county.
John Cranley only has a city to cover, so it'll be very interesting to see the type of work that he's able to accomplish with reaching these voters. It'll make a big difference.
You know, and I don't think that – I think that as we look at the race, you know, field organizing was not his only problem. I think he has a messaging problem as well. His commercials were about the streetcar. I think people are increasingly tired, at least in the city, of hearing about the streetcar. And so I think he's got a messaging issue and maybe a personality issue. The voters we talked to at the polls on election day, on the primary election day, you know, a lot of them just didn't really like the mayor all that much. And I think that's a problem for him. And so I'm kind of waiting to see and, you know, whether there's going to be different messaging, whether there's going to be, you know, what he's going to do to talk to voters one-on-one and in campaign commercials and what he's going to say about the future of what he wants to do in his second term. We haven't heard a lot about that. That op-ed that I mentioned that the mayor wrote the other day that was in the Inquirer, it was kind of one of those where he was pointing out Simpson's inconsistencies in positions where she might have said one thing and voted a different way. And, you know, when you talk to people, there's always explanations for why that occurs. But if you're explaining, you're kind of losing. So it's interesting to me that he went with that tactic rather than, you know, looking forward and saying, here's 5 things I'm going to do in the future on these issues. So, but he's kind of gone to a message of, well, you may not like me, but you know where I stand on things. And it's kind of a message that you know, I'm not as inconsistent as her. You can trust me to carry out what I say. And so, you know, maybe there's been a little bit of a change, but, you know, I'm not sure that's going to do it.
Has there been any reaction from the Simpson campaign to what Mayor Cranley's done here?
I don't think it's a huge surprise. I mean, I think everyone knew that that was kind of his weak spot, and that I think it would be a bigger surprise if he hadn't changed tactics, frankly, if he was still kind of running the same type of negative campaign ads and counting on commercials and those sorts of things to get him through and not getting out on the ground game more often. So I think they were probably expecting this, and I think they kind of continue to stay the course that they had initially planned to go.
Yeah, I don't think she's scared of it or anything. You know, I think she still expects to win, and she, you know, she's going to depend on a lot of volunteers, a lot of people who are, you know, longtime supporters of her to get the word out. So, go ahead.
I was just going to say her biggest challenge still, I think, remains fundraising, getting those dollars so she can get on air, run ads. She has to do that no matter how good her ground game is, just to compete. And I think that's still their biggest challenge right now.
And I think we'll know those fundraising numbers. I believe it's July 31st. Mm-hmm. They've already had to file those reports. They were due at the beginning of July, maybe, or late June, early July. That was the deadline. So,
yeah. You know, speaking of numbers, the latest ridership numbers for the streetcar in the month of June were pretty good. They were up quite a bit, if I understand correctly. But Chris, as I understand, the chairman of the committee that's set up to improve the operations of the streetcar, he's still got some concerns at this point. And I think it deals a lot with messaging for the streetcar, doesn't it?
Right. They think that they need some marketing money. They need at least $100,000, maybe more, to pay somebody and to kind of have a little bit of a marketing operation around the streetcar. Other cities that have streetcar projects already have that. And so the chairman of this committee, who's Ted Torbeck, the former CEO of Cincinnati Bell, believes that they need to be doing, you know, guerrilla marketing on this type of thing to make sure people are aware that it's there and how they can use it and things like that. So and during the budget process for the streetcar, they cut the request from SORTA, the bus agency that oversees the streetcar's operation. So there was potentially a little bit of money for marketing, but now they're kind of back to the drawing board and trying to figure out how much money is there. On ridership, I should also note that while it's up from on June, you know, it's up in June from the previous months, it is not up from the projections. It's still about 30% below what they had projected. So streetcar critics will say, hey, look, you guys said it was going to get better during the summer months when we had all these people downtown and Reds games and whatever. It has gotten better, but it's still missing the mark on what you guys guessed it would be.
We will continue our weekly review of the news, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us for a look at this week's top stories in Cincinnati are WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Chris, there was some news about U.S. Bank Arena this week. What's the latest here?
Yeah, huge, huge news on U.S. Bank Arena. You know, although what they've floated out here is a financing plan to demolish the current arena and replace it. Now, about a year ago, they said they floated the idea of extending the quarter cent sales tax that we are using right now to rehabilitate Union Terminal, to extend that for 7 years, and that would be the main way to pay for a new riverfront arena. So they had said that about a year ago. They filled in some blanks this week on how that would all work. Basically, they would turn over the site and the new arena. They would be publicly owned, like Paul Brown Stadium and Great American Ballpark. And the Port Authority would basically own it. They would hire Niederlander to manage it. Niederlander would sell the arena at a reduced price, although some are skeptical that it's worth much at all, but that's their contribution to it. It would be about, I think, in the 30 million, 20 million-ish range below what they believe the market value of it is. And there would be some other things where they would take some of the revenue from events and put that into the overall financing plan. So it's an interesting idea, and it comes at a time when the county is wrestling with a lot of these needs. Todd Portoon and I talked earlier today. He said he thinks there's at least 10 major projects, and that would include things like the Western Hills Viaduct, the Convention Center. So they have a lot on their plate, a lot to pay for potentially, and so they're going to be looking at that next week and trying to figure out a process to basically decide how that would go. I will say that the current plan for U.S. Bank Arena, that Ray Harris, the COO of Nederlander Entertainment, the owner of the arena, it's not been particularly well received by the county commissioners. They do not like the idea of extending that sales tax further into the future.
And I think Port Authority Chairman Charlie Lucan said pretty much said his initial reaction was no
right.
to this as well. Yeah.
Right. I'm a little bit curious about that because the Port Authority seems to come out the best for this, assuming these numbers actually work out, and that's a big assumption. But they would get about $9 million in revenue a year, and they have long wanted a source of funding so that they can buy up these old industrial sites and kind of convert them into job creating, you know, sites for companies. So they actually come out looking pretty good in this potential plan, but it sounds like they've kind of thrown cold water on it as well.
Well, and if I understand correctly, they're not talking about creating a new tax. They're talking about tapping into the existing
yes.
tax structure.
But I think there's a lot of people that want to tap into that
yeah.
sales tax once Union Terminal, you know, is complete. And I think maybe FC Cincinnati might be interested in that for their stadium. Now, they've said, you know, they don't want new taxes. Could continuing
right.
that tax be part of it? I think there's interest. Obviously, there's interest from SORTA in adding. They can tap into a different sales tax portion, but they want to add that on. But I also think Todd might have some interest in maybe continuing that sales tax for some transportation issues. So I think a lot of people are just trying to get, I think what U.S. Bank Arena is doing is trying to get, hey, can we have a piece of this out before it goes away?
Everybody wants a piece of the pie.
Yeah, and the convention center too. I think that's an option for that.
And the convention center is important. I talked with Portu today, and this will be in a story that will be posted later today at CincinnatiBusinessCourier.com. what he told me was that, you know, he doesn't like this sales tax plan, but he is willing to look at a plan that would kind of package the convention center and U.S. Bank Arena together, and basically the private sector would have to contribute a far larger chunk than what Nederlander is proposing, but that they would be willing to take a look at using some of the hotel motel tax that funds the convention center and use that, you know, kind of draft off of that for both the convention center and an arena overhaul.
That is also something that John Cranley told us earlier this year that he was interested in as well, so with the hotel motel tax.
Right.
The one thing the one challenge they face is we did some research and our hotel motel tax is pretty high. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at, does that price you out of the markets that you're now trying to compete with building this new convention center?
It seems to me that the hotel motel tax would have to increase. I mean, this is basically what Portoon said. It would have to probably increase a little bit, but there's also some bonding capacity coming up that will be available. So they expanded the convention center 10 years ago, maybe more than that, 15, something like that. And so they borrowed some money to do that, and it's those bonds are about paid off. So that money becomes available again to do more work on it. So altogether, it's unclear how much money would be available from that tax, but clearly they think that there's enough if the private sector stepped up to do something at U.S. Bank Arena.
Have they assigned a price tag to all this, what they think it would cost? Because they're talking about a pretty extensive renovation, right?
Well, just to be clear, they're talking about demolition, complete demolition of the current
arena.
Starting
all over again.
And,
okay.
Right. So the price tag for that is about $370 million total. The reason it's, you know, when you build a new arena, it's often way more than that. And one of the reasons that they think that they can do it for that cheap is all the utilities are already available. The infrastructure needed is already there. So it's a matter of just replacing the structure.
So what's next for all this? The voters have to put something about this on the ballot?
I do think the county will start to address these issues next week.
Okay.
Todd's been talking about this meeting for a very long time. And I think it kind of comes down to what priority. Again, if the FC Cincinnati Stadium becomes a priority, then it's first in line because they have to have a deal done by the end of this year. So it kind of just depends what does the county want to prioritize first?
Yeah, I mean, he's going to have some pretty extensive process here, so I think it could be a while before we know. I mean, the Nederlander people made it clear that they would expect the tax to go to a public vote, so you know that's really a sticky wicket, I think.
Especially if you have sort of putting a sales tax on the ballot next year.
Now, Hamilton County's clerk of courts, Aftab Purival, he's raising wages, and now he's offering paid family leave to the people in his department. So, Chris, what are the specifics of this? What exactly is he doing here?
So he raised the minimum wage or the livable wage in his office. So everybody gets paid at least $16 an hour now. The lowest paid person, he said, was being paid around a little bit north of $20,000 a year, which he kind of termed as a poverty wage. And, you know, depending on how many family members they have and whatnot, it would be. That's true. And then he also offered paid family leave for new births for either mother or the father, and also a couple weeks of paid leave to take care of a relative. He believes that this is, you know, something that some private companies offer, and that his office needs to be competitive with those companies.
So $16 an hour would translate to what, about $32,000 a year?
When I did the math, I mean, it depends on whether I don't know whether they have a 37 and a half hour work week at the county or a 40 hour. So that it depends on what that is. But yeah, it's north of $30,000 a year. So it's a pretty good raise for that person who was making only $20,000 a year. He got a ton of coverage of this. It just kind of proves what a kind of rising political star I was. All three, four news stations were there. I was there. The Inquirer was there. So this is a guy who's getting a lot of attention for this kind of stuff. And people think he's he's somebody who's going to be moving up in politics. Although he swears he's completing his term. So
don't they all say that?
Yeah, they pretty much do.
Telling, though, because this is something he campaigned on, big changes, and he's delivering them pretty quickly. And you can't say the same for a lot of politicians that have campaign promises on the trail and you don't hear about it again once they get into office.
The thing about his campaign promises is they can be accomplished without legislative action. Mm-hmm. So he has to just basically figure out how to make the math work, and he can do them.
How did he make the math work for this, by the way?
Well, he's...
He had made some changes earlier in the year that had saved like $500,000 already.
Yeah, he laid some people off that he felt were political hires and didn't really have much of a function and saved some money that way and did some other tinkering here and there. So it's the kind of cuts that voters love because they're not going to notice any changes. In fact, he increased the hours for one of the functions of his office. I believe the title offices in the county are now open on Saturdays, which they weren't before. He kind of viewed that as a revenue loser because if you're in Hamilton County and you need to clear up your title, then, and I did this personally, like I was like, I'm not going to do this in the middle of the week. So I went out to Butler County to deal with it. And so he viewed it as, you know, here's a situation where we're not open on Saturday and the county is losing money because other counties are.
Now, how many clerk of courts employees with the $16 an hour wage, how many of them are affected by that?
I think he said in the range of 80.
Okay. And there are about, 200-some employees in his department?
I thought it was as high as 270. I don't know.
Okay.
Quit quizzing me on math, Mark.
It's math day.
Yeah, you're asking us to calculate wages? We're reporters.
Amanda, I'm just wondering, too, if this is an idea that might spread to other county departments.
The other county departments, though, are still very run by very conservative leaders on some, you know, you have Joe Dieters, obviously. The commission, I think, might be inspired to look at it if they haven't already. You kind of wonder why they haven't as I'm saying this out loud because they are run by two Democrats. And
yeah, I mean, I think Aftab Purival, you know, told us that, yeah, he'd like to see the other county departments take a look at it. And you know, I'd be curious, and we haven't done any reporting on it, but I don't know how many. I wonder how many employees there are in the county wide who make under $16 an hour.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I know Todd Portune has brought that up several times that there's county employees out there that are in poverty level wages. So you kind of do wonder why it hasn't come up there.
One thing I forgot about this was he cut the salaries of some employees who he felt were overpaid. So there were some higher paid people at the top end of his department, and that was one way that he was able to do this. So, you know, the money at the county's tight too, so they don't have a lot of breathing room. But he's tried to be you know, as creative and flexible as he can in order to accomplish these things.
And real quickly, Chris, as we wrap up this segment, there was a poll that was done about how to pay for the Brent Spence Bridge, that long-running debate. How do we pay for this thing? What did the poll show?
It showed that and keep in mind, this was a poll of the region, not just of the city or not just of Northern Kentucky or whatever. It showed that more than that about 60% of the region want the Brent Spence Bridge done, and they view tolls as a reasonable way to pay for it.
So tolls wins in this particular poll.
And tolls even won at the Northern Kentucky level. There was a lot of consternation by Northern Kentucky United, the anti-tolling group, that, you know, how dare they say that Northern Kentucky favors tolls. I asked the people who did the poll, which was the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. I was like, okay, you polled 800 people on this. How many of them were Northern Kentucky folks? And the answer was about 172. So, but the cross tabs or that segment of the poll, it showed a clear majority above 50%, you know, favoring a bridge with tolls if that's what it takes. Now, keep in mind, they put the toll at about a dollar, and I'm not sure that's what it'll end up being. But for whatever it's worth, that's what the results were.
But tolls wins for now. Well, Amanda and Chris, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wedrick. Coming up, Ohio starts its fiscal year with a $65 billion budget, and Governor Kasich's veto to protect the Medicaid expansion survives for now. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly news review. And joining us now, Cincinnati Inquirer government reporter Jesse Balmert, Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson, as we look at what's going on at the state level. And you can join the conversation, 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jesse, Karen, and Howard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks.
Ohio starting its new fiscal year with a $65 billion budget, and state representatives voted to override 11 of Governor Kasich's vetoes. Karen, most of those, I think it was 9, dealt with Medicaid in particular.
Right. Exactly. 9 dealt with Medicaid. And the one big one that's still out there, and you mentioned it before we came into this part of the show, was the one that would freeze Medicaid in expansion enrollment. That was the one that could potentially, as we've been told by people who don't want to see that happen, up to 500,000 Ohioans of the 700,000 plus who got Medicaid through the expansion, that could affect them. So there's a real concern about what would happen with that population. But right now, that veto stands. The House, when they came back and vetoed these other 11 items, said they had the votes to go ahead and do this, but they chose not to, which I would think would irritate people who wanted to see that happen, because if you had the votes, why not just go ahead and do it? But they said that they wanted to wait and see what happens with the federal health care bill in Washington.
So they're just waiting for the Senate to act?
No, because I think the veto has to start in the House.
Right.
Yeah, the veto on the...
No, I mean,
no, he's talking about the U.S.
I'm talking about the U.S.
Oh, yes,
they're waiting to see
how
the whole healthcare debate pans out at the federal level.
That's what we were told that day. Now, of course, it's really hard to say exactly. You know, they told us, House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger said that they had the votes, but there are other reporters who have said, hey, by their count, the votes were not there. So this was what we were told.
I think that is a very odd explanation, to tell you the truth.
The House Speaker, after all of these other overrides were done, we kind of had a gaggle like we normally do, and he said that they had the votes to do it, but they wanted to wait again for the federal officials to do whatever they're going to do. But in conversations with other lawmakers and people who are kind of in the know, there was some hesitation on some folks to vote for this. And I think the sentiment is, if you're not completely sure, why bring it up for a vote now, have it fail when you can just preserve it for later? And this is something they can come back to any time before the end of 2018. So,
which is interesting right there in and of itself, that they could come back at the end of 2018, December of 2018, when this enrollment, you know, the re-enrollment starts again next summer. You know, they could come back 6 months later and go ahead and override this veto, but that's the way the process works.
I'm not in a state house every day, but from what you two are telling me, it's clear to me that they don't have the votes at this point.
I think that's a fair assessment.
I think there's certainly a lot of questions about whether they would have the votes to go ahead. Absolutely.
Okay. And he would need 60 votes. Is that right, Karen?
Exactly, 60 votes. There are 66 Republicans in the House. And you need to remember, though, that not everybody, while the budget did pass, not everybody is on board with everything in the right. budget. And so when you start trying to override one particular item, not all Republicans are on board with this. I mean, there was one Republican, Jay Edwards, who's from Southeast Ohio, who had said very clearly he would not be supporting the override of the veto on the Medicaid expansion enrollment freeze. So lawmakers who really feel like Medicaid expansion is helping in some way, they could not be counted on.
And I think you're seeing much like at the federal level, at the Ohio level, there are different levels of conservatism, even in the state house GOP. So there were some people who voted against the budget because it included any form of Medicaid expansion in it. So you're going to have those people on one side and then other people who are maybe a little bit concerned about how this affects drug treatment in Ohio during this particular heroin and opioid crisis. So you're getting a variety of perspectives, even from the same party. And obviously, they're not going to get any help from the Democrats because they are not going to vote to freeze Medicaid.
Yeah, I think Karen made a good point, too. I think that any state representative from Southeast Ohio, where you've got chronic unemployment, where you've got deep poverty, is going to have a very hard time voting to override this veto.
Well, and also anybody who's in a district that's been ravaged by this opioid crisis that Jesse just mentioned.
Absolutely. Right.
And that is really hitting rural areas very hard.
Sure.
And so a lot of these rural lawmakers are coming here. They come here with conservative ideology, but they also are aware of what's happening in their own districts with regard to the opioid crisis and Medicaid and Medicaid expansion. And so I think it's a very tough decision for a lot of these folks.
Yes.
So I think these are all good reasons why that override vote did not happen.
How many people are covered by Medicaid in Ohio, Karen?
Well, we've got about 3 million people in Ohio. No, more than 2 million people overall in Ohio. 700,000 that were covered, more than 700,000 covered by this expansion, which was made possible under the Affordable Care Act, though Governor Kasich was very, very clear to make sure that we all knew that he was no supporter of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. But right now, the federal health care law could potentially pull that back and get rid of Medicaid expansion. That could leave those people who make up to about 138% of the federal poverty level, which I think is about $28,000 for a family of three, somewhere in there. These are people who are poor, but are not so poor that they are automatically receiving Medicaid.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember, too, that Governor Kasich did this Medicaid expansion by doing an end run around the mm-hmm. Republicans in the legislature.
And I think
that
one thing that's interesting to note of these vetoes is one that's specifically related to this panel, the controlling board that mm-hmm. Governor Kasich right. went to expand Medicaid because he knew he couldn't get the legislature to agree to it. Well, now, if the House and Senate both override this veto, the House has already done this, the Kasich administration would have to go back to that same controlling board, though different lawmakers sit on it now, and ask for permission to spend some Medicaid money every 6 months. And that locks up a certain level of Medicaid money that the budget director says makes the Medicaid program unstable.
So
go
ahead, Jesse.
Oh, sorry. You mentioned 9 of these 11 vetoes or overrides of vetoes are related to Medicaid, and a lot of them are focusing on kind of gaining back that legislative control over this program. And I think a lot of that sentiment comes from Kasich going around them to begin with. But a lot of it is just this is a costly program and they want to feel like they have control over it.
So this is a bit of a rebuke to Governor Kasich.
Oh, it's absolutely. I mean, there were speeches on the floor talking about taking back legislative authority. Bill Seitz, for instance, from Cincinnati, made one of these speeches. There are some lawmakers who really feel like they've lost control, like Jesse said, over the spending in this program. I mean, Medicaid is half the state budget. It's huge. And there are some folks who are really afraid that it's going to take a bigger and bigger chunk of the budget, especially if we go into recession. And so there need to be some guardrails, some controls put on it. But on the other side of that is how do you help people who are low income but not so poor that they're automatically getting Medicaid? How do you help them access health care, especially in a situation like now where we've got this opioid crisis, so many people do need treatment?
Yes, and overrides are not the typical procedure so much. I mean, it is obviously part of the process, but the last time there was any override was 2006, and the last time there were multiple overrides was like 1977 when there were three. So this is the first time Governor Kasich has ever had his veto overridden, but it's also just not something that the legislature has done to any governor in recent history.
So do the overrides, and I apologize if you mentioned this earlier, but do the overrides still need approval from the Ohio Senate? Do all 11 of these, they still need to be approved?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And right now the Senate, Jesse and I were just looking at our calendars here before you brought us on. We were trying to figure out when the Senate might come back to do that. They've canceled. They had a session set for next week, but that's been canceled. So it may be a while, and I don't know that they're necessarily in a big hurry. I know that there were some senators who were concerned about some things in the budget. And once again, people who might have voted for the budget might be against certain provisions, and when those individual provisions come up for a veto override, well, that's going to create problems for people who are really opposed to them.
I think I'd be surprised if all 11 of these make it through the Senate. I think they'll probably pick off a few of them, and I think they would have rushed back a little bit quicker had they been looking at that Medicaid freeze, for lack of a better term. But since they aren't, I don't think they're in a huge rush.
I think that's right.
Yep, I think so.
But the fiscal year started July 1st, Karen. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, we had a big party.
We had a big party.
Did you have a big party? Well, okay. Everybody has a big fiscal
I marked the occasion,
party,
the fiscal
right?
year party. Yeah. Absolutely. But we do have a budget in place, correct? I mean,
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
It's just that these...
Yeah, we have these issues that are
still cropping
right.
up.
And I'd like to mention, too, that, you know, we've been covering this for a while, the whole idea of we were running a budget shortfall for quite a long time in the fiscal year that just ended. The state was very proud to say that they ended the fiscal year in the black. But it's interesting to note that it was, you know, one half of 1% remained, and there was underspending in Medicaid that got a lot of the credit for that. Well, now the budget director is saying because of what the legislature did with Medicaid, they've made the program unstable. They haven't put he estimates almost $1.5 billion short in Medicaid. So the next fiscal year, this fiscal year that we're in right now, could be very, very difficult if the budget director's projections are to be believed.
So is he saying that would be a $1.5 billion deficit they would have to fill?
That's what he's suggesting, that because lawmakers did certain things and made certain moves, he says that the program is underfunded right now and it's unstable. Now, lawmakers disagree with that. They feel that they've gotten a little bit more control over it. So we'll have to see.
Yeah. Well, Tim Keene is essentially saying that they didn't put enough money into the system to fund Medicaid, and some of these overrides would cause that to be even more of a crunch, and Kasich vetoed these items specifically to try to put more money into that program. But the lawmakers on the other side would say that we've overestimated Medicaid in the past, and so, you know, you don't need as much money as you think you need, essentially.
But at least for now, the Medicaid expansion is intact.
As it is for right now, yes. But, you know, every day we're hearing different things from Washington. So who knows what's going to happen next week?
Yeah.
And one of these overrides is something that would force them to go to the controlling board a lot more, this panel that Kasich used previously. And so that could tie the money up. I mean, it's money that they are going to have to not be sure if they're going to get every time. So... the big ticket item wasn't overridden, but there are a lot of smaller things that could certainly affect the Medicaid program.
Now, if they do come back, and you said they have till what, December 2018? Is that what I heard, Karen?
That's correct. Yes. So there's still time.
what if they did come back and nothing's happened at the federal level? They come back and they veto his or they override this particular veto.
I don't know how that works. I don't know how that looks. And nobody wants to talk about that because it really is very speculative. But that would be really extraordinary because people would have had 6 months on Medicaid expansion. I don't know how you actually pull that out. I would think if they're going to do it and they have the votes to do it, they're going to have to do it before next July when the next fiscal year starts.
Now, something lawmakers didn't try to override, and that was Governor Kasich's veto of a tax incentive for boosting jobs in the rural parts of Ohio. And Jesse, can you first give us some background on that? What was that particular tax incentive?
So essentially, it was a tax incentive for creation of rural jobs and I think some other like high, you know, big industry type jobs. I'm sorry, I can't remember precisely. So basically, it was a tax credit for businesses to create jobs in those areas. And it sounds like, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. And it was actually proposed by a Butler County lawmaker, so an area that could potentially benefit from those jobs. But a number of other states have had this program and just haven't seen the results that one would have hoped. Like, there wasn't enough job creation, tax incentives weren't doing what they had hoped they would do. And I think there were just too many questions about this program that was kind of slipped into the budget at the last minute. And so one of my colleagues wrote about it, and I think the governor vetoed it.
It was like $60 million in tax credits, if I remember right. So, yeah. So, and it just wasn't working well in states that have tried similar programs. So that was the concern over it. Governor Kasich was the one who eventually axed this. Is that right?
He was the one who axed it, and then lawmakers obviously had the chance to override it, and they didn't. I think it's something that you could see come back, but maybe with a little bit more time and a few more committees and, you know, find out if this works or doesn't work.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And Karen, I understand Ohio has an execution that's set for later this month.
Yes. This would be the first one in, I think, about three years. And this gentleman has been first in line for quite a while. His name is Ronald Phillips. He was convicted of killing his girlfriend's young daughter back in, I think, 1993. I don't know if this execution is going to go forward or not. I mean, the legal way to the execution has been cleared, but I think that there still might be I don't know if the state has the execution drugs to make this happen. So this is something that's going to be something we're going to be watching over the next 2 weeks. There are already anti-death penalty protesters who've been up here at the State House making known their concerns about this. But I think if the state has the drugs to do it, I think that they are legally cleared to go ahead and do it. That's just going to be the question that I have anyway.
So the whole debate was whether Ohio's lethal injection method is constitutional in this particular person's instance.
Right. And the reason why this was being discussed is because Ohio once again changed its execution protocol. It was having trouble accessing the drugs that it needed, that it had defined as these are the drugs we're going to use for lethal injection. They'd had trouble acquiring those drugs, as many other states have had. And so when they finally settled on this new method that prompted the lawsuit from inmates saying that it's unconstitutional, it uses a drug called midazolam, which has been problematic in other executions, including in Oklahoma. And so the ruling from the courts was that it was okay to use. And so that has kind of cleared the way, at least legally, for this to happen.
So how many demonstrations have there been over this? How much protesting has there been, Karen?
Well, so far, just there was one this week. I expect another one next week. And then, you know, as we get closer, I expect to see the folks who are very concerned about this. Because, again, it's the first time in 3 years that this would be happening. But, you know, this has been something that has been around for a long time. You've got lawmakers who have talked for years about they're concerned about the way the death penalty is administered. You've heard prominent people such as the former Lucasville warden, the late Terry Collins, Jim Petro, the former attorney general, Governor Bob Taft, have talked about their concerns about how the law is applied and how the death penalty is actually put in place in Ohio. And so, you know, there are some people who are very concerned about that. There's a state representative, Niraj Antani, who's from the Dayton area, who is a strong conservative Republican who's come out against the death penalty. And so, you know, there are some concerns about it, but those people who support it say that if it's in the law, it should be applied. Juries make this decision, and the state needs to go ahead and carry out that sentence.
And as far as you know, like you were saying earlier, you don't know at this point whether Ronald Phillips' execution might be delayed or not.
I mean, the prisons department is telling us that this is a go, that practices are happening. You know, I think we'll find out the closer we get. But as I can see right now, the way is clear. But, you know, I witnessed the first execution when executions resumed in the early 90s with Wilford Berry. And I probably went to Lucasville four or five times because it was going to happen that day. And then there was a court challenge. So you can always put that as a possibility.
Yeah, I had one like that too. But you know, there are always protests at every time somebody's executed, and a lot of the times, I mean, it's based on religious grounds.
Yes,
it's based, you know, the Catholic Church, number one, is opposed to capital punishment, just as they're opposed to abortion. And it's the faith leaders, of human life.
Right. And the faith leaders that were here were talking about that. And Niraj Antani, the representative that I just mentioned, you know, he has made the claim that if you're pro-life, you mm-hmm. should be pro-life.
Right.
And that's kind of what some of these faith leaders claim as well.
Michael and Mason joins us now with a question about the Ohio budget. And Michael, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm really enjoying the program today. I was wondering, you guys were mentioning that Medicaid takes up about half the state budget. If we were to pass a law to increase the minimum wage, what kind of impact would that have on Medicaid?
That's a really good question.
Well, you hear that a lot, too. People say if we raise minimum wage, then people wouldn't – they'd have more of a living wage, and they wouldn't have as much of a need for welfare.
But there are some studies that say that there would be more job loss if you passed a minimum wage requirement. It's a really interesting economic discussion to have about what the potential is for what happens if you raise the minimum wage.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of what you believe about the results and the consequences of raising the minimum wage. As Karen says, there are a whole lot of people who believe that a lot of people are going to lose their jobs if there is a increase in a minimum wage.
Jesse.
So, no answer.
No answer.
There's really no answer.
Maybe Jesse has the answer.
Yeah, I'm wondering if Jesse might have the answer here.
No. The more I learn about Ohio's economy, it's one of those things you pull at one string and another string right. comes out on the other end. So, I mean, one of the big topics during the budget this year was about this small business income tax cut and whether they should get rid of that, which obviously would be raising taxes. And so the question is, is the money better spent with Ohioans or in the government? And so you can argue both sides of a lot of coins, but yeah. I think there would be repercussions.
And that was a very good question. It was asked.
Yeah.
It's just one that does not have.
It's a lot that comes up in this
answer.
Debate. Yeah, it comes up a lot in this debate. Yeah,
right.
Exactly. But no really clear answer to it. Karen, as far as the budget itself, since we're back on that, how did education fare in this particular budget?
Well, education was increased overall by about 1%, which is half the rate of inflation. And there was also a big cut for student transportation in the budget. And so a lot of the schools are very concerned. I think there were about 175 schools that got less money. I'm really bad on that number, so that may not be correct. But I know more than half of schools got the same funding or more than they had gotten before. But the increases were really small. And I talked to the budget director for our TV show, The State of Ohio, which airs on PBS stations around the state this weekend, and specifically asked him about that whole idea of education funding being only at half the rate of inflation. And he said this is a realistic reflection of the way things are in the state right now. Education leaders will say that that's not how they view it, but certainly when you're dealing with a budget shortfall that was $849 million
and then became a billion
coming in. Yeah, well, 849 was the last number. 849 okay. million or billion. $849 million was the last
billion.
Number. Yeah, let's. we're not the federal government. but when you're dealing with that kind of a shortfall, and you're trying to project, the budget director really revised down his growth by 1%. So when you're dealing with those kind of constraints, everything has to be pulled back. Did education take a bigger brunt of that than other areas of the budget? Certainly they feel that way. The budget director says it's a reflection of the way things are.
Well, Jesse, Karen, and Howard, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Great to be here.
Thanks.
Cincinnati Inquirer government reporter Jesse Balmert, Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and WVXU Politics reporter Howard Wilkinson.